Welcome to the Grappling Discourse podcast. I'm really excited today. I've got one of my good friends, Sean DeMars, on. Sean is a purple belt here at 10th Planet Decatur. He's one of my favorite training partners. Sean, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. First question I want to ask is, how did you start grappling? When did you first start training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu?
Yeah, I started a little bit later in life. I started when I was 31, right? So I feel really old on the mats a lot of the time. I actually really first got introduced to jiu-jitsu in the Army Combatives Program. So when you join the military, when you go through basic training, I was in the Army as a combat medic, you have to do some like Gracie combatives kind of stuff. And, you know, they teach you how to like pull somebody into your guard and how to do an arm bar and how to do a triangle. And I remember thinking, this will never work. What are we doing here? You know? And then after I got out of that, we had to do another combatives class. And that time I had a little bit more fun. It was a little more interesting. And I got beat up by some guys that I didn't think should be able to beat me up. So I went and trained at an MMA gym when I lived in Seattle, when I was stationed out there. And Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson was the instructor at the time. This was before he was famous, before, you know, he was still fighting in rooms of 100 people, that kind of thing. And some really tiny guys beat the crap out of me while I was there. And I did that for like 3 months. I did MMA training, like more stand up than ground. And I remember I got kicked in the eye once by somebody's shin. And I just thought, what am I doing? I don't have to fight. Why am I here? Why am I here? And so I left. And I've always just been fascinated by the art side of it, right? The less martial, more art. And I've always wanted to do jiu-jitsu because it seemed less martially of all of the arts, right? But just the opportunity never presented itself. I was a missionary for 4 years, and in the middle of the jungle, there's no jiu-jitsu gyms. And I remember I came home on furlough, and I came in and I visited. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
I came in and I visited, and you wrecked me.
Mm-hmm.
This is back when you used to shave your head, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was pretty terrible, but I had really bad joint pain when I got done training. Like I couldn't extend my arms for a while. And this is back when I was powerlifting, and I just thought, well, I guess I can't train jiu-jitsu. And then when I moved back to America, I saw the infamous video of Brandon choking the wrestler out. Right. And then he said, come on down and see us in Decatur, Alabama. No, that's how I found you guys the first time. And then I watched it again and I thought, you know what? I should just go try again and see if I can figure out the joint issues later. And I came, and yeah, man, I've been hooked ever since.
So what is it about the art side of things? Because I do agree, like, there's two types of people that come in, right? There's some that are really more drawn to the martial side and the practical side of using it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's people that fall in love with the movements and the beauty of it. What is it about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in particular that makes it an art to you?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. I think there are a few things that really draw me to jiu-jitsu. Number one is that it's an individual sport, right? So I didn't grow up playing football. And so I don't love the idea of my success depending upon other people, right? That's how so much of life is anyways. If I'm going to set out to have a hobby or something, I don't want my success or failure in this hobby to be dependent upon somebody else's work ethic, somebody else's intelligence, somebody else's whatever. The other aspect of it is I really do love wrestling through ideas, solving problems. But I don't like to do any of it when it comes to like tangible, hands-on material things. So like if my carburetor breaks, I don't want to watch a YouTube video and try to figure out how to take out the carburetor and replace it. But when it comes to like an idea and philosophy that I don't understand, I love to tear it apart and try to make sense of it and then put it back together. I think jiu-jitsu is kind of the best of both of those. It allows me to really use my mind to think to solve problems, and it allows me to, you know, put my hands on something, to be physical. I explain it to people, I just say, yeah, it's kind of like playing chess, except for I get to be a kid again. I get to wrestle, you know. Sitting in front of a chessboard for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever, sounds like my idea of a really bad time. But if you tell me I can get the same benefits and have the same kind of cerebral activity as chess, but I also get to wrestle with somebody, you know, just like we used to do as kids growing up, well, shoot, man, I'll do that anytime. So that's, I think those are the things that really draw me to it. Yeah.
And so you start training and you start falling in love with it as a white belt. And pretty early on. I mean, you're a very busy guy and you've got an interesting schedule because you are a pastor at a church here in Decatur.
Yeah.
So how has your, you know, because people are like, man, you know, you get to train a lot because mm-hmm. your main work and what you're doing is on the weekends, you yeah. know, your Sunday, and then, you know, you're going and seeing people. But how does like your schedule work as a pastor allow you to train? And then what other things, you know, do you focus on to improve yourself outside of, you know, jiu-jitsu?
Yeah. So let's talk about the schedule. So actually, I think Sunday is probably my calmest day. I think Monday through usually Thursday is I'm nose to the grindstone, especially in my small church. If I don't do it, it doesn't get done. So I wake up on Monday morning with a sense of I've got a lot to accomplish before Sunday. And Sunday is the day where I kind of just get to chill and kind of reap the rewards of all the stuff that I've done throughout the week. Being a pastor is kind of like being a small business owner. People think that a small business owner has this incredible life of leisure and freedom, but really that business owns him. And he's got this tremendous amount of pressure to get everything done. And I experience that in many ways. Having said that, it is more flexible, right? So it may have a greater grip on me than a traditional job, like a 9-to-5, where, for example, my phone rings at 9 o'clock, I have to answer it, right? A member of the church needs me, I'm going to be there. Having said that, I can also leave the church for 2 hours during the day and come and train. And so I take advantage of that. Twice a week, I leave and I come here and train during the day. And so I'll either go in a little bit earlier or I'll go in a little bit later. But what I tell people all the time, and this is for spiritual things, this is for physical training, anything like that, is we always make time for the things we care about, right? We always, you say like, oh man, I have trouble reading the Bible, and I'm talking from my world, right? Okay, well, you make time for these other things you care about, for that new TV show, right? Oh man, I just can't find the time to work out. But you can find the time to go drinking, right? So we always make the time for the things that we care about. And I really care about jiu-jitsu. But here's where I think the secret lies. I think as human beings, we have to recognize our finite nature. And when you recognize that, I think you realize that you really only have the capacity to do a small number of things well. So for me in my life, what that looks like is I want to be the best husband, father, pastor that I can possibly be. And I think in my life, I have room for one more thing. And for me, jiu-jitsu is that one more thing. Even CrossFit, which is something I was really heavily into before I used to be a lot buffer. CrossFit's taken a backseat because I can't be a really, really good CrossFitter and a really, really good jiu-jitsu player. So I think recognizing how limited you are and really getting rid of everything else and kind of zeroing in on these main things has helped me. That was your first question. I don't remember what the
second one was. Let's just move on. Okay. I love that answer. And I think it's beautiful. I love hearing when guys, you know, have those priorities. And I couldn't agree more. You know, when you're wearing too many hats, life becomes really, really difficult. And so you've regularly trained. So you've been training for just over 3 years,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
Getting close to probably 3.5 years. And you've consistently trained 5 to 6 days a week.
Yeah.
When did you realize that that was paying off? That you were starting to progress faster than others?
You know, man, until you said that right before we started this interview, I didn't think that that was true. I understand that there are some people who are progressing much slower than the average. Like I see guys and I'm like, man, you're still a white belt. And I'm not trying to say that to be mean, but I'm just like, you're still a white belt, you know, or you've been a blue belt for like 6 years. So I recognize that there are some guys who are slow, but I actually didn't know that I progressed faster than most people. So I'm really excited about that, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, you have, you know, and, you know, typically you're looking at the progression, right, as 2 years is the average belt length, right? So okay. It's going to take you about average 2 years to get your blue belt, 2 years to get your purple belt. And you got your purple belt right at 3 years.
That's right,
an extremely fast purple belt. I really think that, you know, there's definitely like, can you tell a huge difference between, you know, training 5-6 days a week than the guys that are training 1-2 days a week?
Of course. You know, even if you just stop training, if your frequency drops, you can feel it, right? You're not as crisp, your timing isn't as accurate. But I also noticed one of the main differences is between thinkers on the mat and studiers versus people who don't do that, right? Like, so the guys who come in to kill, They may be a handful of, you know, when you're a white belt or a young blue belt, but what you notice is that as you develop a game and as you get better and as you learn the art of jiu-jitsu more, those guys really stay stagnant because they've got one thing and they can just do that one thing really well, you know, or they're really aggressive or they have these attributes. I think the thing that let's take Seth, for example, is stop focusing on me. Seth is one of the smartest people I know, certainly one of the smartest guys in the gym. And I know that that dude, when he's not training, is constantly thinking about jiu-jitsu. He's constantly trying to learn more, you know, very Gordon Ryan-esque, right? Trying to be a real tactician, a real student of the game, trying to be achieve technical mastery on certain things. And so, yeah, I'm like that. I study a lot, and I drill outside of what we do in the gym, and I'm always trying to learn more. And I think those who are trying to learn more end up performing better.
Do you think that one of the biggest keys to your development has been your willingness to learn outside of the gym? Because a lot of guys just come in and maybe they come in twice a week and they just take class and that's all the learning they do and then they roll. How important is do you think to how important do you think it is to learn outside of what your instructors are teaching you?
Yeah, supremely important. I mean, I think the reason why jiu-jitsu has made some of the progress that it's made, it seems like there's been kind of an exponential increase in the overall skill level of jiu-jitsu players in the last, even since I've started. And I think that that's due to people being able to access teaching outside of their normal, you know, normally you're in a gym, you got your black belt, you got a few other black belts if you're lucky, right? And then you got some, and so there's a very limited pool of resources for you to acquire, you know, for new skill acquisition. But if you have a couple extra bucks or even just the time to scour YouTube and you're not an idiot and you don't try all the stupid stuff on there, but you look for solid free material out there, you can be constantly learning and learning and learning. So I think it's supremely important. If I just forget everybody else, if I were to just stop and look at my own game and how I'm playing right now as a crappy young purple belt, I would say that you can tell that the base of what I do is really heavily, it's been instilled in me by Brandon to the large extent and then to you. But there's also, I'd say, like a quarter of what I do that I think I do really well that like nobody in this gym ever talks about. You know what I'm saying? And so I'm really thankful to live in a time where we can learn jiu-jitsu on the internet and, you know, watch
So, who have you studied?
it.
Like, who have you benefited the most from studying? And when you're studying, how do you find the most benefit?
Yeah. So in the early days, I really just studied people that I was drawn to, like Marcelo Garcia. His game was just amazing to me. These days, I am really interested in people who can communicate the concepts about jiu-jitsu in a very precise, succinct fashion. Maybe less succinct, more precise. John Danaher, ever heard of him? He talks about, I think this is true of all, this is true outside of jiu-jitsu. The difference between somebody who's smart and somebody who's a really good thinker is your ability to use language to make granular distinctions between ideas. Okay? So I think that people like John Danaher do that exceptionally well. So, for example, in his Kimura DVD, you know, he says, okay, we're going to be talking about the dorsal Kimura. Well, as soon as now there's a bit of a barrier to entry. At first, I'm like, what's dorsal? Oh, well, dorsal is it's coming off the back, right? Okay. So when you have this kind of language initially, it's a little bit of a barrier to entry. But once you learn the language, kind of like with rubber guard, what Brandon was talking about the other day, it allows you to be extremely precise in your instruction and what you're communicating to your students. And it allows you to systematize things in a way that I think is really appealing to me. I know that some people are just very movement connection based, and I think we should probably all be like that, but they don't want to know, you know, the names for this, that, and the third. I really thrive on that. I need you to really do stuff like that. That's really helpful. I think John Danaher does that really well. And other things like the really good teachers have really good cues. So again, going back to John Danaher, one of his cues for fighting off a guillotine is to put your ear to the shoulder of your opponent, right? I heard Brandon the other day say, when somebody's got you in a shoulder crunch, put your eyes over their eyes, right? I think teachers who have those kinds of cues instead of just move your head, right, are really helpful. And so I think there's a reason why John Danaher is the best coach in the world with arguably the best team in the world. I think it's because he's a really good teacher. So if you were to like reword the question, if you were to say like, Sean, somebody has $1,000 and they can only buy $1,000 worth of jiu-jitsu DVDs that will make them the best jiu-jitsu player that they can be throughout through the rest of their career. They can never spend another dollar on jiu-jitsu DVDs. I would say buy John Danaher DVDs because it will give you a really complete game with a really high level teaching.
Interesting. Interesting. And the cues are important. And I think as when you first start teaching, you realize how you talk like, oh, just move your head or just move your arm here. And you start to realize that you don't really know how to communicate what you're doing to the audience. And when you see a guy like John Donahue do it, it's almost mesmerizing because you're like, man, it just makes so much more sense. And when you learn the vocabulary, if you put time to learn in, because I didn't know that's what a dorsal Kimura was. I've heard that and I was like, dude, I have no idea what that is. Maybe that means he's like, Kimura-ing a dolphin or something like that. But that's really interesting. And you as a, you came in as a very, very strong guy, really
And
strong in
handsome.
CrossFit. Yes, handsome with always with a great beard. But you came in very, very strong. But you were a really unique case as well as you've really learned to train gently. How long did it take you to calm down and realize that using your strength was in the long run going to be detrimental?
Yeah, I think I had a couple of advantages on that front. The first advantage was that I was older, so at 31, I'm not going hard as, 21. Another thing is, I remember I talked a little bit about that joint pain that I had. I noticed that the more I would squeeze people, the white belt death grip, the more my elbows would hurt after class. So I started resolving to just relax so that I didn't have to deal with that. And then also, dude, this is so embarrassing. I remember I was training with a girl in the gym when I first got here, and I thought the magic of jiu-jitsu is that if you know jiu-jitsu, it doesn't matter how big you are, how strong you are, you're just a monster, right? You can kill anybody. And I went real heavy on her. Not hard, not spazzy, but real heavy. And Lindsay very kindly the next week said something in passing like, maybe when you're rolling with some of the ladies in the gym, you just kind of be a little bit lighter. And I was like, oh yeah. And that actually embarrassed me. And then you hear chatter around the gym about guys who don't know how to train well. And all of that just kind of converged to make me go, you know what, man, I want to be a good training partner, and then finally, sorry for a long-winded answer, but finally, I pretty quickly realized that the guys who spaz don't learn as quick. And I wanted to learn quickly. I wanna, you know, and so you probably remember very early on as a white belt, I spent 6 months starting most rounds in bottom side control. 'Cause I heard you guys talk about big guys and they don't have a guard and they just get on top and they do key locks, and I was like, you never sat me down and said, hey, Sean, this is a good strategy. But you hear things, you observe things, and I just kind of put it together and I thought, you know what? This is how I'm going to approach things.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I do remember you kind of going through that phase. I didn't realize it was as long as 6 months. And so you end up getting your blue belt and you're really starting to hit a stride. But talk about as you improve, there are obviously the pitfalls that come in anybody's life, especially with a sport that's as difficult as Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. What have been some of the most challenging times? Where have you really struggled in your journey so far?
Yeah, so I think you could probably break that up into like mental struggles, physical struggles. So mentally, I remember the time right before I got my blue belt. I just wanted the blue belt so bad, man. I just felt like I need this win. 'Cause you know how it is as a white belt, you're getting crushed. I remember my first roll with Kevin Primo. I thought I was gonna die. I was making all kinds of noises that I didn't even know my body could make. And you fight your way out of that, right? And I just remember, like, I don't have a dad. I need affirmation. I need somebody to like tell me that like I'm on the right track. So mentally, that was pretty tough. And I kind of went through the same thing before purple belt. Not as bad. I was just really burnt out. I was training so hard. I was really into it, and I just kind of didn't want to be here. But I think one of the I have a lot of character flaws, but one good thing about my character is I just have a strong will for discipline. So I would just be here no matter what, you know. Physically, I think I think it's fair to say I've had more injuries than most people in the gym. And they've all been like super weird. You know, I heel hooked myself when somebody did a hip bump sweep, I landed on my own heel. I tore a tendon in my wrist just putting my hand on someone's neck. And I'm pretty usually dinged up when I train. So that's been pretty challenging, you know, trying to find ways to train with and around injuries.
Yeah, and the mental side, I think, is probably the most challenging. And we all have these secret fears or these secret insecurities that we don't express a lot of the time. And so, as a new belt, like your purple belt, you're kind of not in that state because it's like you just got your purple belt. But it's something funny about when you feel like you're getting close to that next belt, how those insecurities just flare up. So, how did you deal with those insecurities?
I'm an external processor. I'm an extreme extrovert, and I have very little fear of man. I think a lot of people, and I'm not saying that it's a pat on my back, maybe it's a character flaw, but I've just never really cared too much what people think. So I'm the guy in a class. I'll raise my hand and be the village idiot and ask the stupid question. I'll ask 10 of them. I don't care, you know. I'm the same way with like how I'm feeling, you know. So I remember one day and I was talking to Brandon and I told him like, yeah, like not having my blue belt's keeping me up at night. You know what I'm saying? Whereas I don't think that's something that most people would share. They wouldn't tell the guy who's going to give them their belt that like they're stressing about the belt, you know. So I think that really helped for me. And then just wait, what was the question again?
Just how you've dealt with
Oh
those
yeah.
things.
How I've dealt with it. Yeah, so I think that's one thing. And the second thing is jiu-jitsu is just not, it's not my life. You know, a lot of people and this can happen in various communities, not just martial arts, not just jiu-jitsu, but this can become an idol in your life. It can become the source of your identity. And so when things are going well, you're doing well. And when things are going poorly, you're crushed. For me, I care, so it bothers me a little bit when things are going poorly, but it's pretty easy for me when I leave here and I get to go be with my church family or I get to go pick my kids up from school to relativize the importance of what I do out there on that mat, which won't really matter very much in the future.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. I dealt with that, especially at Brown Belt, where this was my identity, and I couldn't separate the wins and losses versus my value as a human being. And I do think it is so important to have that grounding of like, no, okay, it's just grappling. Like, you know, you're way more than your wins and losses in any given training session for sure. And so at Purple Belt, what have you really been working on? What do you think you need to do to get to the next level?
Oh man, what do I need to do? So I think when I first got my purple belt, I spent like 3 months. I remember Brandon saying something in passing about like you should have an impenetrable guard. Well, I don't think I'm ever gonna have an impenetrable. Maybe that mindset's why I won't. But I really like just like for 3 months, it was the only thing I'm concerned about when I'm rolling is that you don't pass my guard. Also, I'm just really heavy into leg locks. I don't want to be an imbalanced player. I just love it. I just love leg lock stuff. That's my thing, you know. So I'm working a lot on stuff that for you is probably old hat. For me, there's a thousand ways to enter into K guard, you know, stuff like that. The whole backside 50-50 system, I'm enjoying that. Just the other day, I was thinking, you know what? I really need to develop a closed guard. You know, like I can't be a black belt without having like a moderately okay closed guard. Whereas right now, a new blue belt can give me some pretty, an athletic blue belt will give me a hard time in closed guard. You know, I hit an arm bar from closed guard the other day, which is like day one beginner's jiu-jitsu. And dude, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I am the man. I am Gracie certified, you know?
It's funny how successes in your periphery, like parts of your game, mean so much more than when you get an A game success. You know, whenever you hit something that you are working on that you have struggled in, it is a beautiful thing. And the closed guard's an interesting one because a lot of guys really struggle to find love and joy. It's a very
It
grindy,
is, man.
it's a very tough position to play. And so, you know, the difference, I think, between a black belt level closed guard, like there's a huge difference in a black belt level closed guard and just a guard that you can tap out a dude that hasn't trained, right?
Right.
Like, there's definitely a huge, huge, huge difference. Yeah. And there's so many little subtle things.
One more thing about that. I think there are two ways that I think about what I'm going to be studying and working on. One is what I think I need to do. So, like, I'm doing a lot of wrestling right now. I'm trying to work on new techniques for wrestling. And, like, I'm doing that because, like, same thing with the closed guard. I'm doing that because I feel like in order to really be a solid jiu-jitsu practitioner, I need to be at least, like, a low-level purple belt at wrestling. If I'm a black belt in jiu-jitsu, I want to be halfway decent at wrestling, okay? I want to be able to initiate a takedown. But then there's also just, like, that looks fun. You know what I'm saying? Like, you see somebody do something and you're like, oh, it looks fun, or it just feels like it's calling you. You know, I don't even know how to put it into words, but you probably know exactly what I'm talking about. You see somebody's game and you feel just drawn to it. And So I like when I said like that backside 50-50 stuff, watching Lachlan do that, I just felt drawn into it. Not because he beat all the big guys, but just because of how beautiful and elegant it looked, you know? So. Yeah,
very cool. And, you know, talking about the physical side, you know, you've dealt with some injuries, but you, you know, are very serious into your physical being. And you started with CrossFit. You were super, super heavy. A lot of people don't know this. You were like 100 pounds overweight at one point.
Yeah, 310 pounds.
So how did you go from being 310 pounds and being severely obese to, you know.
I wouldn't say severely. My 600-pound wife. Okay.
Yeah, he was obese. Very obese. And to the point now where, you know, you're a guy that, I mean, I gained so much from just talking to you about, you know, weightlifting. And you helped me a bunch, you know.
Thanks, man.
So how do you, again, go from 310 to where you are today?
So I've been into sports performance, weightlifting and stuff for years. But a long part of that time was spent in powerlifting, which is like, you know, you can never be too big. You know, if you need two CPAPs to help you get through your sleep apnea, you know, get two CPAPs. I think things turned around for me when we went down to South America to go to the mission field, and we were in the middle of the jungle, and I just thought I was going to die. You know, it was so hot. We had to work so hard on a daily basis just to survive. And honestly, I was just like, I'm too fat to be doing this. Almost like what I expect people, you know, who are overweight or smoking during a pandemic to say to themselves, you know, like, this is the wrong time for me to be 400 pounds, or this is the right time for me to quit smoking. I got to the jungle, and, you know, the American lifestyle of comfort and affluence didn't allow me to just not be concerned with my weight. And so I just got after it, man. I just thought CrossFit was probably the most efficient way to do it. I jumped on that train, and it was the main thing that I did for a while until jiu-jitsu came in and took over.
And so you just started doing the WODs then? Were you just looking at the WODs online and then?
No, I was, a little bit for inspiration sometimes, but, I mean, CrossFit's not super hard. You can just say, I'm going to do something for 20 minutes, or you can say, I'm going to do it for max reps. And then you figure out from there. But, I would have, like, we would build like our own boxes, and, you know, we didn't have barbells and stuff like that out there. So you fill bags up with sand, or you find new and creative ways to mix up air squats and push-ups and leg raises. And so you just kind of threw it all together as I went. And then when I got to America and I had access to real equipment, then I got to kick it up a notch.
And so I want to give you two scenarios.
Okay.
The first scenario is I'm an elite competitor. Okay.
As you are.
I'm a purple belt trying to become a world champion, trying to make it to ADCC one day.
Sure.
How would you add a lifting routine? Like, what would a lifting routine look like for you any given week?
Yeah.
And, you know, how would you become the strongest, best athlete you could getting ready for competition?
Yeah. So whenever you're talking about, so like for a lot of CrossFit athletes, like they become better CrossFitters, but there's not a sport specific aspect to their training because CrossFit is the sport, right? Same thing with, in general, things like powerlifting and bodybuilding. Like, bodybuilding is very aesthetic in nature. So there's no sport specific aspect to your training. Whereas like a D1 football player or wrestler, whatever training they do, you want it to supplement what they already are as an athlete, not detract from it, right? So what you don't want is some coach who's going to come in and be like, all right, we're doing 10 sets of 10 on deadlifts. And then after that, we're doing, 5x5 bench. And then we're going to go run sprints. And now he's susceptible to injuries. He's overtrained. He's doing things that aren't really going to help him be a better whatever, a tight end or a forward or. So I think, if you're a jiu-jitsu player, you want to do stuff that's going to accentuate your ability to perform on the mats. And I think there are a couple of things that you need there. One, you need a high level of GPP. That stands for general physical preparedness. Think about pulling a sled, okay? Unless you're a dog pulling in the Iditarod in Alaska, okay? Pulling a sled doesn't really have a whole lot of sport specific functionality to it. But what it does is if you can pull a sled and then carry a sandbag and then run 400 meters and then do 100 burpees or whatever, is it does just give you a base level of fitness that allows you to train hard and not be worn out by it, right? So let me just give you an example. When I was really heavy into CrossFit, I would come in here and I would get wrecked because I didn't have the sport specific aspect down. I wasn't technical and all that stuff, but I would be wrecked. But in an hour, I would feel perfectly fine to go train again. I had a very high level of general physical preparedness. I could recover quickly. I wasn't easily overtrained. So I think a high level jiu-jitsu person needs to have just good all around just general physical fitness so that you go and you do ADCC and you have four really hard matches. Let's say you have overtime in each one of your matches. Well, if you get to your third match, you're not going to be dead after your second match because of that GPP. Okay, so that's one. And then two, I think it depends on the athlete. So let's just take Seth, for example. I tried, Seth, if you're listening to this, I'm sorry to throw you under the bus, buddy. I tried to get him to get into some CrossFit kind of stuff, but I wanted to tailor it specifically to him. I wanted to him to incorporate some weights, and he was pretty resistant to it. But when I look at someone like Seth and his gangly chicken legs, right, I think what you need is some baseline strength in the squat and the deadlift, right? Whereas you take someone like Matt, what's the big wrestler, Matt, the judo
Oh,
guy?
Anderson.
Yeah, you take someone like Matt, and if I were to program something for him, I wouldn't have him do any lifting whatsoever. He's got a baseline of strength that will probably get him through the rest of his career if he just does supplemental work. I would have him doing other agility based stuff. So a lot of stuff that you do actually. I think you have a great blend, but anyway, so all that to say, to not give you a really good answer on the second part, I think it's very person specific.
I got you. I
Yeah,
got you.
athlete specific.
And so now, though, we've got a 43-year-old. He is been training 7 months. He's still got about 40 pounds to lose. He
Yeah.
trains twice a week. He just wants to kind of bulletproof his body,
Yeah.
and he wants to lose some weight at the same time.
Yeah.
How would you program, without overtraining for somebody
Sure.
like that? They don't have that,
Yeah.
general preparedness. Like
Yeah.
they very unprepared for adding
Yeah.
extra strenuous work.
Yeah.
So how would you take somebody like that? Because those guys, I think, are the ones that struggle the most,
Yeah, that's right.
with their physical fitness and getting to a point where, they are prepared for the training.
Yeah, you gave me a couple of key pieces of data there. 40 years old, overweight, training jiu-jitsu twice a week. Right. I would probably, and if this was real life, ask more questions. Are you able to sleep? How's your house? Is it in your job? Is it really stressful? Because all those things matter, right? But let's just assume that apart from those three factors, he has a general base level of stress that's very typical that we all have, nothing too extreme, and no health issues, no other than being overweight. And nothing, no injuries. I would have him start just doing some body weight movements to, doing things like an air squat. I think if you want to know how somebody's body is doing, you ask them to do an air squat, and if they can, that's great. If they can't, I'm worried. Burpees, running, just doing whatever I can to get them to function like a normal human being and keep them breathing hard while they're doing it. Starting at a low level of intensity because, a 21-year-old who's not accustomed to intensity, they will acclimate really quick. But a 40-year-old, I'll probably have to start him on just 2 days a week of moderately intense exercise for 20 to 30 minutes, and then really have him hone in on those recovery times. And then as time progresses, maybe add an extra day, maybe increase the intensity and reduce the time domain, maybe start adding in weights, you know, stuff like that. Whereas if it was like a 20-year-old, I'd like, get in there and get your butt kicked, come back, see me tomorrow, I'm going to kick your butt again, you know. So, yeah, that's probably how I'd approach it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so now, last piece on this physical side, like recovery, you know, because you are a guy that's constantly moving, constantly working out, constantly training jiu-jitsu. You know, what do you prioritize when it comes to recovery? And, you know, what should the average person, like, where do you think they're messing up? What's the biggest thing they're missing?
Oh, that's an interesting, the biggest thing people are messing up. So, I think this may be an area, I think we've talked about this before. This is an area where you and I are not necessarily on the same page, but, I think most of the stuff that people do for recovery doesn't actually facilitate recovery. So, foam rolling, chiropractic adjustments, the Theragun. Now, listen, if you've got a knot in the Theragun, you can feel it help you work out the knot. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about you saying, I'm going to use this on my thighs for increased blood flow, okay, or cupping or any number of different things that is, I think, a modern equivalent to snake oil stuff. Now, having said that, the placebo effect is real, okay? I mean, it's real. It's been documented. You know, you can take this medicine, which is nothing but a sugar pill, and you can feel like your pain's been relieved. But I think one of the main, so let me come full circle. I think one of the main issues is that people focus so much on ridiculous recovery techniques that are really not proven that they neglect the things that are proven. Okay. It's like people who take 10,000 supplements, none of which are proven, but there's like this handful of supplements like beta-alanine and creatine that are guaranteed proven effective for athletes and they don't take them, you know, or getting an extra hour of sleep at night instead of staying up drinking and playing video games or whatever I imagine you would do. I think that's probably the main issue. People focus on stuff that's really not that effective and they neglect the things like a healthy diet, good rest, and a bunch of other stuff that a stress-free lifestyle that has been proven to facilitate recovery.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think we definitely differed more a year ago, but as of, you know, right now, I don't like do ice baths anymore.
Right.
Because I haven't done one this year.
Wow.
Because my carnivore diet, like took care of the arthritis that I was using it for. And then I've really prioritized making sure I get 8 to 9 hours of sleep every night. And yeah, it's like, I don't need to do, I'm not jumping into ice water anymore, don't need to. So I think that's really interesting. So, you know, a couple more questions, almost done, but 5 years from now, where do you see yourself? Where would you like to be with your jiu-jitsu?
You know, man, I really have a passion to teach. I think I'm just a born teacher. I think my joy in anything, any particular thing that I enjoy reaches its apex, like it climaxes when I'm able to share it with someone else. You know, I'm the guy who's, I eat a new restaurant. We did this with tacos, right? Like there's a taco joint in town. I'm like, Matt, we gotta go, right? Or there's a new movie. Dude, you gotta see this. Or there's that new book, you know, let's talk about this new book together. And I love jiu-jitsu and I love everything about it. And so, I was just talking with Brandon the other day, man, like, hey, I don't know if this is presumptuous, but I would love to teach, you know? So I love this gym. I love you and Brandon and Lindsay and the environment you've created here. And I hope that in the future I can be useful as a teacher in some way. And if not formally, then maybe informally, you know, just I love after a role to be like, hey, you did this good. And I noticed you did that. Stop doing that. Here's why. Sometimes people don't love that. And maybe sometimes that's due to the way you communicated or relational dynamics. But anyways, I always just, in 5 years, I hope that I'm the guy on the mat that people know he doesn't compete. He's not going to go to ADCC because he's old and broken, but he's a monster and he's really helpful and he's really kind and loving.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Very, very, very well put. And, you know, now talking just a little bit more, you know, about your faith life, because I think a lot of guys, you know, in jiu-jitsu, I think we got a lot of like conspiracy theorists, a lot of like People that are kind of had bad experiences with the church, and without, give me like a 5-minute infomercial on why I should attend church.
Can I talk to you about my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, what has God done in your life? And just kind of talk about that.
Yeah, man. So I was a drug dealing gangbanger when I was 18, and Jesus saved me. And my life has just not been the same since. I mean, I can't share here everything about my life up to that point, but it was pretty terrible. And when I tell people stories, they almost can't believe it. I mean, actually they can't. But then everything about my life changed, man. I went from caring about, money, sex, drugs, power, to caring about other people more than myself, overnight. And then I've just tried to live that out, which is really hard. You know, it's really hard to live that out consistently. But it's always funny because I don't look like a typical pastor. I don't act like a typical pastor. I'm not, hey brother, like I'm myself, But man, I just tried to follow Jesus and help other people to do that. And, just try to be faithful, man. Faithful to my church as a good pastor, faithful to my wife as a good husband, faithful to my daughters, faithful training partner, Yeah, nothing special.
I just love the message. I think the one thing that really sticks out to me is just the ability to care for others even when they've wronged you. And I think there's times, I think a lot about in jiu-jitsu, the time that I've actually struggled the most is when I'm being selfish with my jiu-jitsu and about my jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting parallel, I think, between, jiu-jitsu and faith and really anything, right?
Right.
So I guess the last question I'll end with is, how has, faith...
The last question on the faith thing?
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. Cool.
The faith, how faith plays a part in your role in jiu-jitsu.
I've actually thought about this recently. I have the kind of personality, and maybe in this limited context, people can't perceive it, but I have kind of a jarring personality. I have an abrasive personality, a big personality, which can bother some people, sarcastic sense of humor, which can bother people. I'm an extrovert, I'm an external processor. And what that means is that, it's easy for there to be friction in any community where I find myself. And for most of my life, before I became a Christian, that meant that there was pretty regularly conflict because of the way that I responded to that. And I think my faith has really been one of the main ways that I have found my path in this community. When I first got here, I know that there were some people who weren't super fond of me. And I think if I didn't have my faith, I would have responded in kind. You say something nasty about me, I'm going to say something nasty about you. But when I think about the way that Christ has loved me, even when I didn't deserve it, that just informs the way I treat that person. So, okay, you said something nasty about me. Well, next time I see you, I'm going to genuinely, this is not affected. This is genuine. I'm going to ask you how you're doing. How's your family doing? I heard you had an injury. How's that going? Can I help you? Can I serve you in any way? When I mess up in the gym and Brandon is about to kill me because I broke one of the rules, I don't go, freaking, you can't tell me what to do. I go, man, Brandon, man, I really value you, and I'm sorry. Can you forgive me? Let me start over and try again. I promise I won't be an idiot next time. I wasn't like that before I became a Christian. It was like, well, if that's how it's going to be, then screw you. So I think it's really more than like learning jiu-jitsu. It's affected me interpersonally, and that's really important because you can't do jiu-jitsu by yourself. You can't do it. I mean, maybe you and your buddy can get halfway good in a garage, right? But in order to get this rock solid training, you have to be in community with people. And I think my faith has made it easier for me to do that. As compared to somebody else who maybe just is naturally super easy to be around, maybe they don't need the faith to be able to do that, but that's not me, so.
Very much a very similar story. I'm definitely a rebel and one that could be, especially, wasn't abrasive, but if I was met with you know, disrespect,
yeah.
I would return it tenfold.
Yeah,
you know?
You're right, right, right.
So I can totally vibe with that. So I guess really the last thing I want to say is there anything else you want
to
say? Or...
Well, you asked me a question that I thought would be interesting before the interview to talk about a little bit, the rebel thing.
Oh, yeah,
I don't even know where you were going to go with that, but I think
Yeah. So I think especially you just mentioned an embrace of attitude. There are times that you have start, you know, with just a couple of little rules. Maybe mm-hmm. it's foot locking white belt. Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. Just little things like that. Yeah. You've definitely broken some of the unspoken rules of jujitsu at that time. And then a spoken rule of jujitsu.
That's right. Yeah.
And, you know, I had some of those same, and I still do a little bit, you know, that rebellion side in me.
Mm-hmm.
How has it helped your jujitsu? And how has it also hurt your jujitsu?
Man, that may be the best question of the whole interview right there.
Okay. And like, perfect way to end.
And this is going to be just a lot of external processing because I'm not sure I have the answer, right?
Okay.
I think it's probably hurt my jiu-jitsu. Here's an easy example, okay? I'm not doing a lot of classes right now. I'm in the place with my jiu-jitsu right now where I just want to study where I want to study. And I know that's not good, right? Because I know that, like, for example, like Brandon's rubber guard series right now. Like, I know deep down in my heart I should probably be in on those classes, right? But like I think a lot of people, they might be like, they would care what Brandon thinks, or they wouldn't want to look weird coming in late, you know, coming in just to roll what other people would say about them, because people do say stuff, you know, and I just don't give a crap, right? So I think that that's probably going to hurt me. Like I'll probably be a black belt if I get there and look back and be like, man, I should have sat in on those rubber guard classes, right? But I think it's also helped me because... You know, anytime you're able to think outside of the box just a little bit, you usually see things that other people don't see, you know, and you don't want to get carried away with that. Right. You know, you don't want to be the guy who is always the contrarian, who's always playing the devil's advocate, who's always, you know, every rule is made to be broken. No, rules are typically standard of practice due to wisdom, you know, smart people with good hearts put these kind of either spoken or unspoken parameters in place, and for very good reasons. Okay. So I think you have to be selective about it, but I think when you, with wisdom, and when you mess up, when you're quick to recognize it and fix it, rebel just a little bit, it just opens you up to new things, you know? So, and maybe an example of that for me would be, no matter how much you press me, I don't want to be competitive. I just don't, I'm not a competitive person. And I think that's allowed me to be really relaxed on the mats, and it's allowed me to take my ego out of it a lot more. And I've gotten a chance to learn things that I don't think I would have been able to learn otherwise. So just like every other good thing in this fallen world, your big strength is also a great weakness, and you just got to try to strike that balance. And so I'm hoping to do that.
I remember I was, I just got done teaching a class, and I was watching Rolling. It was a Monday night, and you toe-holded a white belt.
Wait, when was it? Not recently.
Right? No. A long time ago. This is like probably
okay.
a year and a half,
okay.
2 years ago. And I remember, like, you hit a toe hold, and I remember just getting so mad at you. And I remember, like,
I remember that. Yeah.
I remember I was like, I don't care that you footlocked the white belt.
Right,
I don't
right.
think you're actually going to hurt this. I'm mad because your jiu-jitsu's better than toe holding this white belt.
That's right.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, how did footlocking white belts help your jiu-jitsu?
Well, if Brandon asked, it did not help at all, and I will never do it again.
Yeah, okay.
But having said that, I think as a blue belt, my leg locking game was just far and away better than most blue belts, you know, because I practiced it. But I shouldn't have. Anyways.
You know, as a blue belt, because here's the tricky thing, you know, because as a blue belt, you can't just go, okay, I can only heel hook these blue, purple, brown, and black belts, but you're a brand new blue belt. Like, getting there and actually finishing and learning to
right.
do it is almost impossible. And so it can be a bit of a detriment, you know, when you are practicing offensive, especially if you do get super fascinated with heel hooks and toe holds.
Yeah.
And so it is a very interesting, it's a hard balance, you know, to play, because, you know, what does John Donahue always say? No, you need to train 70% of the time with people that
right.
you're better than, that you
right.
can dictate where the role goes.
Yeah.
And so it is one of those tricky things, you know, because, you know, your story is a fascinating one just for that rebellion part.
Yeah.
There are some good things about it, but at the same time, couple of bad things happened when you were like locking white belts as well.
Yeah. You know, and it's super tricky, man. Like, you'll roll with guys and they'll be like, oh no, I'm a white belt, but you can leg lock me. And you're like, oh, okay. Or sometimes you'll leg lock someone and like Brandon will see and he'll just kind of wink and look away. You're like, wait, did you just give me, do I have a pass now? Well, you just broke that guy's foot. So now not only do you not have a pass, but you're in big trouble, you know? So yeah, man, it was a super interesting dynamic. You gave me the best advice actually to work past that when I got my purple belt. You just told me like, hey man, maybe just don't roll with any white belts for a while, you know, kind of get it out of your system. And I think that really helped, you know, I think it taught me, because I worked through that and I tried to think like, why am I doing this? It's not because I want to be rebellious, you know, but obviously that's what it's resulted in. So I think your advice was practically the most helpful.
Okay,
Yeah, man.
well, that's awesome. And again, I think it's an interesting part of your story. And I had it, and I definitely want to go into more detail in a podcast by myself, where,
Sure.
you know, I definitely, you know, wasn't going to classes at Purple Belt a bunch. There's something about the Purple Belt. What is it about Purple Belt that makes guys, though, want to be, you know,
Yeah.
start missing class, wants to just start taking, you know, more control of their training compared to what their senseis or coaches are telling them to
Yeah,
do?
I think there's a couple things. One, you're usually pretty burnt out. And that's relative, right, to each person. But that was a big part of it for me. Two, like for me as well, like I have a family and other responsibilities, and I just thought, you know what? Jiu-jitsu is supposed to add to my life, and if I don't want to be here to do a class, I don't want to be here. And I'm really, really thankful. If you're listening and you're not a member of our gym, sucks for you. I'm just really thankful that Brandon runs the gym in such a way where he lets you have your own path, you know, because I probably would have quit by now if he didn't, you know. And I'm really thankful to be able to do that. But I just had other priorities, and I was like, if I'm going to cut my time in half from jiu-jitsu, I'm probably going to do it just by shaving classes off. And then another thing is you know, listen, you come to class, let's say you've been training for 3 years, okay? It's you didn't want to be here, you're tired, you're burnt out, you have other priorities, but you commit, you're disciplined, you show up, and you're doing, it just so happens in God's providence, the same dogfight lesson that you've learned 6 times in class, you know, and you're just like, shoot me now, right? You really, what you should do is say, oh, great, I'm going to get to shore up some of the finer details and really sharpen the sword. But really, what you say is, man, you know what? I was hoping to learn something new today. And guess what? I'm learning the same dogfight sweep. Or you show up and it's like, by purple belt, you kind of have a sense of where your game is and where it's going. And it's like, today we're doing rubber guard, you know, or maybe you love rubber guard and you don't care at all about half guard. Or no, that's not true, but you know, whatever. And you're just like, you know. So I think around purple belt, you just like a teenager, you just start to feel like you know more than you do, and you more independent than you should be, and all those factors converge to you just being a little bit more independent. But I've seen in you and Brandon and Lindsay, you know, a humility. I see you guys sitting in on classes doing stuff that I know you've done 1,000 times, and learning from people who are not nearly as good as you, and so. I'm hoping that for me personally, this is just kind of like a phase, and then like I'll get through it and come back around and be more normal. Is there hope for that?
You know, what happened with me is I just started to feel and a little bit different in that I was always so competitive. I wanted to be the best guy in the gym. I wanted to be one of the best guys in the 10th planet system, one of the best guys in the world.
Right.
And so I felt like I was limiting my ability to make connections when I sat out of class, you know? Like I just was like, no, I'm better than everybody. And then I'd roll trying to beat everybody. And so I just felt alone, you know, at brown belt, especially at brown belt when I was doing that. And so my path back was more of a, no, I just want to be like, I want to join the tribe again, you know? You know? So probably a little bit different since again, you were, you know, you're not as competitive in the sense of like, oh, I have to be the best. Like me, it was like, I have to be the best. I've got to find a way. I want to be better than Brandon, better than Eddie, better than everybody, you know?
Man,
And it just was a lot of pressure.
it's a big
And
burden to
it
carry.
was a huge burden. And again, it definitely, you talk about overtraining and being burnt out. So I felt at brown belt. So now it's just more of, well, you know, like I'm really more take class to, dude, I learn things. You never know. Sometimes I'll learn and get an amazing idea. Sometimes I go just to be a part of like, just like a white belt. Like, no, I'm one of you guys. So any final thoughts, anything you want to say to the people?
Man, I'm just really thankful to be able to do jiu-jitsu. I think it's a crazy fun hobby that, in Decatur, Alabama, there's like one of the sickest jiu-jitsu gyms in the whole country, and we have a fantastic, head coach, as he prefers to be called, our master sensei. And then, with you and Lindsay, I love the vibe here. I love the freedom of the gym. Yeah, I just love so much about being able to train, but specifically being able to train here. So, yeah, I'm just really thankful, man, and I'm glad to be on your podcast. I'm sure that your many subscribers aren't over the moon to listen to a mid-level purple belt talk about his views on things in jiu-jitsu. So hopefully, I won't be too embarrassed by some of the stuff I said here in a couple years.
That's the way it is. Some of the things I said at Blue and Purple Belt, I was like, oh my goodness, dude. But part of the journey.
But
Well,
not me though. I'm different. I'm gonna look back and
Well, Sean, I appreciate you coming on. I love you, man. You're one of my favorite training partners. I think the sky's the limit. And I think you're gonna be a fantastic benefit to jiu-jitsu, not just this gym, but just jiu-jitsu overall one day. So thank you.
Thanks, bro.